Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan, and that's it. I am the only host that you get today. So let me explain what's going on and why I'm here by myself. As you guys know, we just had Fear the Con 8, which was a great success. Big thanks to everyone that was involved in that. We'll talk about that a little bit more in a future episode. But the point being, that con was paid for by a Kickstarter. And throughout the history of the show, I have made no secret of the fact that I have a big love for spaceship combat. So capital ships duking it out. And I've written some blog posts about capital ship combat, but some people have been wanting to hear me go on a big Dan Eksher, huge gush about how much I love capital ships and what I look for in capital ship combat. And since that was one of the backer rewards, that's what we're doing for this week's episode. Now, if you have absolutely no interest in this whatsoever, you think this entire topic is boring and cannot imagine listening to me for what may be a good 2 hours, then that's totally fine. We will be back next week with a more typical Fear the Boot episode where there's going to be multiple hosts and we talk about tabletop gaming and all that kind of stuff. So what I'm doing now is for the subset of people that listen to our show that want to hear this and a subset of those people that actually paid to hear this. All right, so let's get down to it. I want to start by setting some parameters to what we're going to be talking about here. But before even I do that, one of the things I have to mention, because if I don't, this will be like the first 10 comments on the blog, is there is a website out there called Project Row, and I will link to that in the show notes. And what Project Row is it's a website that is dedicated to a very realistic view of what space combat would look like. And as I understand it, this is a site that's done by people that either are professional scientists or people at least who are doing what I would consider beyond the lay level of thinking about these kinds of topics. And I have read a good deal of Project Row. I like Project Row. It is not Project Row that informed my views. I developed these on my own, though it is certainly true that in many cases I will overlap with what's being said on that website. So I'll put that in the show notes if you want to read it and see what they have to say. All right, so let's start by setting some parameters to this discussion. And I want to start by telling you what I intend to allow and not allow as I'm talking about this. Now, I don't claim to have any insight into what the future holds technologically. I'm not a prophet. I'm not a futurist. I'm not a scientist. And so while I have looked into this enough to have some understanding of the things I'm talking about, I'm not going to pretend to know what society is going to be doing in 50 or 100 or 200 or 1,000 years. All right. So what I'm going to try and do is build off of a modern day understanding of science and technology that gives enough of a leeway in there to tell the kinds of fictional stories that are most common in science fiction. Okay, so we're going to allow for fairly well-developed energy weapons and faster than light drives and things like that, but I'm still going to keep this to a fairly hard scientific basis in terms of the way things work. I don't feel comfortable trying to do more than that, because while I think pontificating about what the future might look like is a lot of fun, if you look at the history of science fiction or the history of just human speculation in general, we almost seem to consistently miss one or more major technologies that really come out of nowhere and radically change the way the world works. The internet, the microprocessor, the internal combustion engine, et cetera, et cetera. And even when people get those, even when people guess those, first of all, I oftentimes chalk that up to just you get enough people guessing on the future, and by mathematical averages, somebody's going to ballpark it. But even if we presuppose somehow they really do have some brilliant ahead of their times intellectual insight into what's happening, the other thing they can't oftentimes get, dare I say never get, is the implications of these technologies. The fact that these technologies create secondary technologies or cultural traits that play back into how things work out, okay? So for example, even if you say that somebody might have foreseen the modern automobile, I don't think they foresaw things like the drive-through restaurant and the effect that traffic has on human physiology, you know, the stress levels and such. And so I want to keep that kind of stuff to a minimum. Now, I believe in any conversation, any discussion, one of the most important things you can do is define your terms. And this is something we do on Fear the Boot all the time. When we have a topic, we set it up, we explain it. I may not use this phrase, but what I'm going for is defining the terms, because if we cannot have a common understanding of the subject matter, then we're just going to be talking past each other when we're discussing all these things. And so there's going to be a couple terms I'm going to define later, because I think they need some context to really be explained. But I do want to lead off with one, which is defining what exactly is a capital ship, because I think most people have down the idea that it's a big ship, and that is correct, but the term does have a more specific meaning. If we look at it within the context of military, naval conflicts and thinking, a capital ship means the largest ships of a naval line, okay? So if we talk about the capital ships of the late 20th and early 21st century navies, we're talking about things like supercarriers. If America had not mothballed them, we'd be talking about things like battleships. Now, when you move into science fiction, it is fairly common that capital ship takes on a more loose meaning, that we're talking about large ships, but not necessarily the largest ships. So a capital ship might be defined as something that could be a frigate or a destroyer or a cruiser, something that's a lot smaller than the biggest ships of a force, but these are still being differentiated from things like small craft, such as fighters or personal craft or light freighters and such. And so you're at least trying to draw some kind of a line between the littler ships and the bigger ships. And since we're dealing with science fiction here and not modern day naval conflicts, I'm going to be using that second definition of a capital ship. So a capital ship simply means a big ship out in space. And precisely what a big ship means obviously can come down to the scale of the fiction that you are using. And incidentally, that's a theme that I'm going to have in here both implicitly and explicitly all over the place. While I'm going to try and give some specific definitions, all of this is cooked to taste. So if you want your fiction a little different than mine, or you interpret something a little different than I do, that is 100% fine. It's not as if my taste on this is the one and only truth. All right, let's move on then. Chapter 1, The Unique Nature of Space Combat. Now, I'm a big fan of space sims. I love games like Elite, the original one I'm talking about here, Space Rogue, Wing Commander, Free Space, X-Wing, TIE Fighter. And I'm really happy that after, it seems like a 10 or 15 year break from those kinds of games, that they're starting to come back again with things like Elite Dangerous and Star Citizen. I love these kinds of games. And a couple of them do get the gist of space combat right. But most of them go for something that is far more familiar to us, but is incredibly inaccurate to how space works, which is basically what they do is they have space combat work like atmospheric combat. So if you look at, let's take a game like X-Wing or TIE Fighter, the fighters in that game are not behaving like they're in space. They are behaving like World War I or World War II dogfighters. All right, now let's talk about why space is different than atmospheric combat, because everything we're going to discuss in the course of this episode is going to tie back to the fact that space doesn't work like the combat we are most familiar with. For starters, there is no atmosphere, and also there is no gravity, okay? Assuming you're not caught in a gravity well like you're close to a planet. If you're just out there somewhere in space, there is no really noteworthy atmosphere, and there is no noteworthy gravity. Now, what this means is that there is no outside force really acting upon your ship. Let's think about this in terms of atmospheric or terrestrial objects, okay, things that happen on or around a planet. Obviously, you guys know that if I take an airplane, that its wings are shaped a certain way to create high and low pressure, which allows for things like lift, and we're going to put some kind of power to this airplane in the form of a jet engine or an actual rocket or a propeller or whatever, that's going to start pushing air out the back. And this is going to be enough force to lift this plane off the ground. But if I cut those engines, okay, so if I turn off that source of power, then what's going to happen is my plane is going to glide for a time. But obviously, that plane at some point is going to return to the ground, and gracefully or not so gracefully, it is going to impact, okay? It's going to crash or it's going to land. It's not going to stay aloft if we don't keep putting some kind of thrust behind that. Well, why is that? Okay, well, obviously, gravity is a big factor. Gravity is pulling this aircraft down. But the other factor is air. There is a pressure, there's a friction that is created by the air around this airplane that is constantly slowing it down. Just like if you're swimming through a pool, if you push off one side of the pool, eventually the pressure and the friction created by the water is going to stop you. And it's the same thing when we're talking about air, okay? So it's going to stop that airplane, and that airplane is going to decelerate, and it's going to start going down because it doesn't have that lift anymore. Now, another way you can think about this is if you're flying at something, okay? Let's say it's World War II, and you're going to do a strafing run on somebody's naval ship, some cruiser that's out there in the ocean. Well, you know that if you turn at this cruiser and you fire your guns or your rockets or torpedoes or whatever it is your plane's equipped with, and then you pull up, well, what's going to happen? Well, of course, that plane is going to immediately change direction because as you turn the plane, the flight surfaces, okay, the wings and such of this plane are actually being reshaped by the controls of your plane in such a way that you are creating more friction, more drag on certain parts of the plane and less on others. So what happens is just as that engine is accelerating you into a new direction, so now instead of, let's say, going forward and down, now you're going right and up, it just as it's pulling you into that new direction, things like the resistance of air are going to remove that velocity, that movement that you had in that other direction. So your plane is now going up and right. It's not going down and forward anymore. That's not true in space. For starters, because of the fact that you have no significant resistance acting upon your vessel, when you turn on the engines, you are not going to a speed. Okay? What you are doing is you are accelerating. In a car, I have to keep pressing the accelerator to keep my car moving, because the resistance of the air and the weight of the car is going to keep slowing it down until eventually it stops. So I have to keep adding energy into the system to keep my car going. But if we're out in space and I start burning the thrusters, it's not like there's some air pressure slowing me down. That's just not happening. And so what happens is I just keep going faster and faster and faster and faster as long as those engines are on. And the moment I cut off those engines, while I will now have a consistent speed because there's no new energy being introduced in this to accelerate my spaceship, my speed's going to remain consistent. Unless I hit another object, nothing is going to slow me down. So if I accelerate until I'm going 1,000 miles per hour and then I cut the engines, I'm still going 1,000 miles per hour forever and ever, amen, until something strikes my spacecraft. So I want you to think about this in terms of a game like X-Wing. You know, if you're doing that bombing run on a Star Destroyer, you come in, guns blazing, you fire off your proton torpedoes. If you've got your power grid set up a certain way and you've got the throttle maxed out, well, you're going a consistent speed. And once you get close to that Star Destroyer, you pull back, you pitch the X-Wing or whatever up, and you immediately swoop up and turn away from that Star Destroyer. That's atmospheric combat. That's how something works in air and gravity. That is not what happens in space. What would actually happen is something more like this. If you have your throttle on, you're not going to reach a speed. You're just going to keep accelerating. And when you then get close to that Star Destroyer and decide to suddenly turn your nose up so you don't ram it, what happens is not like in an atmosphere where you just kind of slip through the air and take on a new direction. What happens instead now is your ship, even though you turn the nose up, is still going in the same direction it was before, because there is nothing resisting it. There's nothing acting upon it. And if you've got your thrusters now burning in a different direction because you just tilted the ship 90 degrees upward, well, what happens is you're still going forward. Okay, you're still going toward that Star Destroyer, but now you are also introducing some what we'll call upward movement. And I realize space doesn't have up and down the way a planet does, but just bear with me for sake of argument. All right, so you're introducing some additional energy to move you in another direction. And there's actually a really simple way you can look at this mathematically. Let's say I accelerate towards that Star Destroyer for 30 seconds. And then when I get close to it and I fired off my lasers, I fired off my torpedoes, and I turn up and I am now turned vertical, so 90 degrees upwards, from that Star Destroyer for 5 seconds. What direction am I going? Okay, in atmospheric flight, it'd be easy. You're going up now. In space, here's how you do it. Take a piece of paper and draw a line that is 30 units long. Okay, let's say, I don't know, centimeters if you prefer, because I don't think 30 inches is going to fit on the average piece of paper. So let's say you draw a line that is 30 centimeters long. Okay, this represents the total amount of acceleration that you have expressed in this original direction. Now, if you flip the ship upward and you burn for 5 seconds, what you would do is you'd go to the end of that line and you would create a 90 degree angle. Okay, so if you draw a 30 centimeter line going left and right, now at the end of that line, you draw a 5 centimeter line going up. So now you have this nice little right angle. Well, if you take a ruler and you complete that angle to make a triangle, so you go from the starting point on the left to the ending point on the upper right, you now have a diagonal line. That diagonal line, that represents the ending direction that your ship is moving in. All right, so as you can picture, or even better if you're drawing this out, you can see that even though you turned the nose up and burned hard for 5 seconds, you're still moving more or less in the same direction you were when you started out. As a side note to anyone that's really physics or math minded, you may be thinking, wait a minute, that triangle thing you just described is technically for velocity, not acceleration, which is true. But if you assume a constant rate of acceleration, then the math does work out such that the average velocity on both sides would create the exact same proportion. So we'll just let it work for this little example. All right, next concept is I want you to understand that space is large. Now, most people get this at the basic intellectual level. If I say space is big, it'd take an idiot to debate that. Obviously, people will say, yeah, okay, space is big. And you can see these little demonstrations all over the internet where if you can imagine the sun was the size of a pea, then the earth would be so many feet away and the nearest solar system would be so many miles away. And you get these little thought experiments about how big space is. But I want to think about this in terms of ground combat, because I think that makes a good sort of reference point. All right, if we look at the Earth, the Earth is about 40,000 kilometers in circumference. All right, for anyone playing the American version of the game, that's about 24,000 or 25,000 miles. All right, so if you were to stretch out a string around the Earth at its widest point, it's going to be roughly 40,000 kilometers long. Now, that means the longest distance you would have to fire to hit anything on the Earth is, of course, half of that, because nothing can be farther away from you than the opposite side of the planet. And so the longest any weapon would have to fire is 20,000 kilometers. And obviously, we do have some weapons that can do things like this. For example, intercontinental ballistic missiles, the giant nukes that, you know, we scary things that a couple countries have, the U.S. included. But let's talk about something even smaller than that. The U.S. military has something called the XM-2001 Crusader artillery piece. Now, if this artillery piece fires unassisted, it can accurately strike a target 30 kilometers away. Okay, if you're playing the American version of the game, it's about 18 miles away. If it has outside help with targeting, it can accurately hit a target about 50 kilometers away or 30 miles away. Now, I want you to compare and contrast that for a moment to games like X-Wing or Free Space. And I'm going to use X-Wing here because I actually know the exact numbers. In X-Wing, your lasers had a maximum effective range of 1.5 kilometers. That's only about 1 mile. Your proton torpedoes, I believe, were the longest ranged weapon in the game. I can't remember if there's some cheese weapon in one of the expansions, but in the main game it was the proton torpedo, and they had a maximum range of 6 kilometers. Okay, so once again, if you're playing the American version of the game, it's about 3.5 miles. That's it. Now, obviously, the distances we're talking about in space is a whole lot more than that. I don't want to belabor this point too much just yet, because I'm going to be coming back to this more in a later chapter where I talk specifically about weapon ranges and such. But I do want to go ahead and at least get the gist of this on the table, because it is what separates space combat from terrestrial combat. Now, let me give you another couple bits of reference here. In August of 2003, Mars moved the closest to the Earth it has been in 50,000 years. And at that distance, Mars was about 56 million kilometers away. Now, if you compare that to the 40,000 kilometers of the circumference of the Earth, you can obviously get a sense we're talking about a whole lot more distance. If we want to talk about averages, the Earth and the Moon roughly sit 384,000 kilometers apart from each other. Okay, so we're talking about a distance that is something in the neighborhood of 10 times the circumference of the Earth. And obviously the Moon is a relatively close astronomical body. So if you imagine two fleets sitting in the water or two groups of tanks fighting it out on land, you're probably talking about distances that are in range anywhere from hundreds of miles at the longest to maybe dozens of miles or even a single digit number of miles at the closest. But when we're thinking about space, I want you to understand that even a relatively close point in space is going to be so much farther away than anything you're going to deal with on land or sea. And I'm going to talk about why that's relevant and how that comes into play in a later chapter. All right, but just keep this factoid in mind. All right, my third point here is there's very little intervening terrain. Now, yes, there is stuff in space, and I think it's fair enough to say that if we had space combat, the things most worth fighting over are going to be things like planets and asteroid belts and whatever. And so, yes, there's going to be some amount of mass that's figuring into the combat. But even planetary orbit is considerably more wide open than something like a city block, forest, or mountain range. And so if you have objects that are quote-unquote, dangerously close to each other, or able to see each other, or able to interact with each other, you're probably talking about a distance that, once again, it's not some single-digit number of kilometers here. You're talking about distances that may be many thousands of kilometers away. Take that as your foundation why space combat is different than the forms of combat we are most familiar with. And I'm going to transition here into Chapter 2 of talking about weapons and distance. But I'm going to lead off Chapter 2 with an idea that I think kind of bridges Chapters 1 and 2, which is, why is our common representation of space combat so similar to atmospheric combat? And I think there's a really simple answer, which is when somebody is telling a story, they're probably inventing it from something they're already familiar with and wanting to convey it in familiar terms to an audience. And so if I want to tell you a story I know that you can get, especially if you think about the fact that a lot of our really formative sci-fi came out of the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, you're talking relatively close on the heels of World War I and World War II, or the Korean War, the Vietnam War, where things like atmospheric combat were very much on the mind of, you know, people that were out there. And this figured in entertainment. There were so many movies about these different conflicts that showed that approach to warfare that I think it became very ingrained in terms of how people look at things. But there's also a, for lack of a better term, a cinematic issue, which is if you have this combat setup where two ships are incredibly far away from each other and are interacting over these vast distances, it really does not convey I think all of the things that someone would want to capture in terms of illustrating that combat, you can't see how the ships are interacting with each other. You can't see one of them banking to turn away from or into the other. You never see them on the screen at the same time. You don't see one kick off a shot and that it impacts the other. And so there's a cinematic reason to want to illustrate them as being in relatively close ranges. But that's not, in all likelihood, how space combat's actually going to work. All right, so let me give you some points of reference here to demonstrate what I'm talking about. Let's take TIE Fighter, or X-Wing. I will go with X-Wing, which was a great video game, by the way. I'm using it as an example here, but I'm not picking on it. I actually really enjoyed that series of games. But if you look at X-Wing, the lasers on your ship had a range of 1.5 kilometers. The proton torpedoes had a range of 6 kilometers. And so, yeah, you might be able to belt off a few shots at someone at significant range, but for the most part, you closed a visual range, you were chasing people around in these very tight dogfights, you were often having to fire even at these close range in ways that would lead the enemy ship, because you'd have to shoot a little bit ahead of them, otherwise your lasers wouldn't hit them. And, you know, it was a lot of fun, but that's really not how things are going to work. So let me give you some examples here. Let's talk about lasers, which obviously move at the speed of light, and weapons that are going to move near the speed of light, so things like particle rays. Light waves move at roughly 300,000 kilometers per second. Okay, it's obviously really freaking fast. So if I fired a laser cannon from the Earth all the way to the moon, all right, now remember, X-Wing, we're talking about 1.5 to 6 kilometers maximum range. Earth to the moon, we're talking somewhere in the neighborhood of 384,000 kilometers off. If I fire a laser at the moon, from the time I pull the trigger to the time it strikes the surface of the moon will be 1.28 seconds. That's it. Now, I want you to imagine something a little bit different here. If the Earth was a hollow sphere, okay, so let's talk about if I was able to shoot someone through the Earth. All right, and I'm just using that as a random thing to give you a sense that I'm talking about big distances here. That distance, so the diameter of the Earth here, is 12,750 kilometers. If I fire a laser gun at someone 12,750 kilometers away, it will strike the person in about 0.04 seconds. Once again, that's 12,750 kilometers. That's a whole lot more than 1.5 kilometers. And so I hope, if nothing else, you're getting the idea that weapons are viable at significantly longer ranges than how most sci-fi portrays them. Now, just to keep playing with the math, let's go a little bit farther out here. Let's say that an enemy fleet shows up in Earth's solar system, and we've got our ships at Earth, and they've got their ships at Mars, and Mars is currently at that August 2003 range of 56 million kilometers. If I fire a laser beam from one ship at a ship out by Mars, okay, so I'm shooting from Earth to Mars, from the time I pull the trigger to the time I hit that ship, all the way at Mars, 56 million kilometers away, it will take about 3 minutes for that shot to hit home. Now let's talk about some mitigating factors, because I don't want anyone to start, taking this a little bit too far. To be able to go from Earth to Mars in 3 minutes, or to be able to go from Earth to the moon in 1.28 seconds, that's awfully freaking fast. But I think it's also fair to say that you can't necessarily expect the target to sit still. I mean, I'm sure everyone listening to the show has fired something. If it's not an actual gun, a BB gun, a pellet gun, a rubber band gun, a spitball, you have fired something at something else. Okay, you understand if it's sitting still, then really the flight time of that object is immaterial. If it's moving, then you cannot shoot where it is. You have to shoot at where it is going to be. You have to lead it. All right, now if we're talking about a distance of something like through the Earth at 0.04 seconds, well, trying to lead something or even just bracket enough fire around it in hopes of getting lucky, that's not real hard to do. But if you start thinking about all the places a ship could be in 3 minutes of movement, well, that's a whole lot of different places. And so unless we presume faster than light weapons or faster than light sensors, then that 3 minutes, even though this is a very feasible range to attack across, is not necessarily a feasible range to hit across. And there's a factor that compounds it even more. If I have my ship at Earth and I want to shoot at an alien ship at Mars, and that shot takes 3 minutes to cover that distance, that's only half of the problem. because how did I know what to shoot at? Well, obviously, I'm going to be looking at some kind of sensor array here. I don't know if I'm looking at visual images or I'm looking at radar pings or whatever it happens to be. But the fact is that energy had to travel from the ship to me. So if there's a ship at Mars and I see it, I can only see it because of the light reflecting off of it. And that light is going to take 3 minutes to reach me. Then I fire my laser, which then goes 3 minutes back. So in other words, I'm not actually shooting this weapon at a 3 minute delay. I'm actually shooting it at a 6 minute delay because I am firing it over a 3 minute path at information that is 3 minutes old. And so what comes into play here is this idea that a ship has to be predictable to be hit at those kinds of ranges. If it's moving at a consistent speed or consistent rate of acceleration in a consistent distance, then you can do a little bit of math and figure out exactly where you need to fire and you can hit the sky. If it's moving in a way that's a little more erratic, but maybe you have some high-end computer that can look for these subconscious patterns that people have in their behaviors. If you've ever played a video game where they talk about things like target prediction, that's generally what they're getting at, is the ability to see not where a ship is, but to guess where it will be. And so maybe that mitigates it a little bit. But of course, you can start stacking layer upon layer here, because maybe at the same time, the enemy ship has something that's counteracting that. And so they've got some kind of computer that's making their movements as confusing as possible so that, you know, you have trouble seeing what it is they're doing. All right. But the point I want to make here is that even though there is kind of an upper limit to this where things get a little bit silly, we can still talk about ranges that are significantly bigger than anything we're used to dealing with on Earth. And you very well could be firing and having, I mean, full out warfare with targets that are an enormous distance away from you. It's not like strafing things such that both ships are on the screen at the same time is the way that this is going to work. Now, the other kind of weapon that we can talk about is an indirect fire weapon. Now, indirect fire weapons are any weapon that does not follow a straight line from its launch point to its impact point. So a laser, a cannon, a particle stream, all of these are direct firing weapons. But if we talk about something like a guided missile, that is an indirect firing weapon. It does not have to begin and end following the same trajectory. Now, indirect fire weapons, they have their own list of advantages and disadvantages. The advantage of an indirect fire weapon is that they can constantly readjust. So if I'm firing my laser beam at this Martian ship and it's being fired across a total 6 minute delay, well, when I launch my missile, it may also be working off of a really long delay. I mean, I'm firing it where the ship was 3 minutes ago when I last spotted it. But as it travels that distance and gets closer and closer and closer to this enemy ship, obviously the delay between that ship and that ship's energy, its light or whatever, reaching the guidance system on the missile is getting shorter and shorter and shorter, because that missile starts out at 56 million kilometers, but it's going to end at 0 kilometers. And so as it gets closer and closer, its information becomes more real time and it can start chasing this target and it can start mitigating some of its abilities to dodge these shots, because it's now looking at where the target is, not where the target was. The downside to an indirect firing weapon like that is they are, unless we introduce some weird technology, going to be significantly slower than a direct fire energy weapon. All right, so whereas a laser is going at 300,000 kilometers per second, missiles, because they're accelerating, once again, space, you don't have a consistent speed. I can't give you what their exact speed is going to be, but I can tell you it's going to be a lot slower than a laser. And so that missile may require hours, days, weeks, possibly even months to cross that same distance. And once it arrives, because it is a trackable object that's moving so much slower than something like a laser is, it's also very possible that the target ship could spot this incoming projectile and shoot it down. And this is not some far-fetched future technology. If you guys want to look up the Phalanx system, that's an anti-missile system that we already have in use. And what it does is it tracks these incoming missiles and other things, and it can target them with this Gatling gun and shoots them down. It's a real thing we have today. And in the same way, point defense system on a ship could theoretically see this missile coming from across the solar system. And as it gets close, it starts to track the missile the same way it would another spaceship. And it just pops it out of space. It just hits it and blows it up. And that's the end of it. Now, once again, you can get into stacking measures on countermeasures on countermeasures. Because, well, maybe that missile has some ability to dodge. Maybe it's following an inconsistent pattern. Maybe it's putting out some kind of interference. It's putting out flares to confuse its heat signature or whatever. And obviously, there's all kinds of ways that you can conceivably get around being shot down. Or heck, if nothing else, if it's economical for you, if you estimate an enemy ship can shoot down 50 missiles before they hit, then launch 1,000. And maybe in your universe, that's economical. I don't know. Your mileage may vary and cook to taste. But I do want to mention at least that an indirect firing weapon is going to have a different role than a direct firing weapon. One closing thought on this is that I don't think missiles are a bad idea, or at least within the technologies that I foresee, are going to become an obsolete concept. But I think something that you do need to keep in mind is, given the vast distances we're talking about and given the possible countermeasures to them, I'm not sure that I buy into missiles being the sort of trump card weapon that games like X-Wing or Wing Commander have made them out to be. So once again, I don't know, cook to taste, blah, blah, blah. But for me personally, I think missiles are great. I just don't know that I would give them the significance that I think they've gotten in sci-fi that, once again, by my estimation, was heavily informed by things like torpedo bombers from World War II. Chapter 3, I want to talk about fighting on the broadside. Over the years, I've actually had a couple people take me to task on this, and it seems like most of the times that's happened, there's a fundamental misunderstanding of what a broadside is and what it actually means even to fight on the broadside. Before I get into that, I actually want to have a little bit of fun here with etymology. I love word histories. So for anyone who's not up on their nautical terms, or anyone who's just curious where some of these terms come from, when you are standing on a ship, if you are facing forward, the right side of the ship is called starboard. Okay, and where that comes from is actually a mangling of an older term of steerboard, because that was the side of the ship upon which the steering oar was kept, the right side of the ship. The left side of the ship was historically called larboard. All right, and if you thought I was going to say port, I'll explain why I didn't here in a second. But it was traditionally called larboard. And this isn't exactly right, but the basic word history there is something to the effect of, imagine it being closer to the modern English of the laden side of a ship. It was the side of the ship that cargo was loaded on and off of, which they would typically do to that side to avoid the steering oar. And so what happened is, as you advanced over the ages, you know, with naval ships and eventually airplanes, the term larboard was dropped because of the fact that it sounds too much like starboard. And as the story goes, that was confusing sailors, especially when they were dealing with really noisy things like, you know, sea storms or something. And so they dropped larboard in favor of port, which fundamentally meant the same thing, because this was the side of the ship that was usually docked to a port. So it was the porting side of the ship, just as before it was the ladening side of the ship. All right, so just a little bit of silliness there. But we're talking about three dimensions in space, so we can't stop there. There's two more sides we need to talk about, which is the dorsal side and the ventral side. Now, if you're having trouble remembering starboard and port, well, that's pretty easy to get down because port has four letters and so does left, okay? And starboard's the other one. But for dorsal and ventral, something that might help you, I can give you a few little mnemonics here, is first of all, if you put them in alphabetical order, the D comes before V, so the D is the one on top. So the dorsal side of a ship is its top. The ventral side is the underside. Another way you might remember it is if you've ever heard about shark sightings, and they talk about the dorsal fin, which is, you know, if you watch Jaws, that's the fin of the shark that's sticking out of the water when you hear that little thing that sounds kind of like the starting bars of the New World Symphony, which I don't think is where it's taken from. That's exactly what it sounds like. But anyway, that's the dorsal fin. And so you have the dorsal side of the ship. All right, so let's get back to broadsides. I've had a few people over the years kind of take me to task on the fighting on the broadsides because they don't see it as practical. I had one person in particular really take me to task, and to be completely blunt, she was being pretty much a bitch. But I do still want to respond to this because some people have asked this in good faith. A lot of people, when they hear the idea of two ships fighting on the broadside, they picture something right out of the Age of Sail, that you have two ships that have their guns going down the starboard and port side of the ship, the right and left side of the ship, and they have to kind of come alongside each other or turn their sides into each other, and then they blast away with their cannons and all this great blowing up and whatever else happens. And that is technically fighting on the broadside. But that is not the only form of fighting on the broadside. The definition of broadside, as it applies to naval combat, is simply any long side of the ship upon which guns are placed. So the broadside of a ship does not have to be a series of fixed cannons on its left or on its right. All right. Now, if we think about the more modern battleships, okay, like the Iowa class of battleships, if you'll recall, they have turrets on the front and on the back that can point in any number of directions, yet these ships are still capable of fighting to the broadside, even though they don't have those big guns, at least, fixed on the right and on the left. All a broadside means, once again, is just a long side of the ship upon which guns are placed. Now, so what that means is if you change the shape of a ship or the way its guns are mounted, you have just changed what the broadside is. Now, the reason the broadside was so fixed in naval combat is because you have to deal with hydrodynamics, the way things move through water. If you want to move through water efficiently, you need a thin, sleek object. That's what's going to move fast. Obviously, something shaped like a typical boat is going to move a whole lot better than something shaped like a brick. And so they have to shape the ship in a certain way, and there simply is not enough room to pile all the guns on the front and back, and so they had to go to the left and right because that's just where the real estate was. And some of this obviously changed over the years as, you know, for example, turrets came to be used more frequently in naval combat. But I want you to keep in mind that in space, because we are not dealing with hydrodynamics or aerodynamics, we don't have any kind of a persistent pressure or resistance upon the ships. Shape is immaterial. You can have a ship that is shaped like a sphere or a cube or a brick or an egg or any number of things. And all of these shapes, at least from the standpoint of moving the ship around, are more or less all equally useful. And yes, you can argue these a little bit if you really want to get into the geometry of rotating some objects or whatever. But bear with me in at least accepting that it matters a lot less than it does for an airplane or for a boat. And so you can shape a spaceship in a whole lot more ways than you can something that has to operate inside of air or inside of water. And so now suddenly you can have the guns be along the front of the ship or the back of the ship, or you can have them be on multiple sides. That's something else I want you to keep in mind, is these ships can conceivably be fighting in 360 degrees. In space, there is no particular up or down. When you talk about surface warfare, and think like a tank or a battleship or whatever, you can guess that your enemies are going to be more or less approaching you along an even plane, you know, give or take some number of degrees, so that you have, I guess, something that looks like a dome or a cylinder that you're trying to deal with. But in space, people could be coming at you from absolutely any direction, 360 degrees by 360 degrees, full sphere here they can come at you from. And in fact, this speaks to one of the alternate designs someone pitched at me, which was to have ships more like a tank, where they have a giant cannon to one side. And well, that sounds great, except if you think about the design of a tank's cannon, it fires in a 360-degree circle with a little bit of elevation and a little bit of declination or pointing down, but it cannot fire through itself. If there was an enemy below it, it would have no way of retaliating against it. And in space, this is a very real possibility that not only a ship is coming at you from that direction, but you may in fact have ships or missiles or fighters or whatever coming at you from multiple directions at once. And so simply saying, well, I'll just roll the ship to point my cannon in that direction really may not fully deal with the problem. You can certainly debate any number of shapes for these capital ships as being viable shapes. And I've heard people suggest cones versus spheres versus rectangles for all these different reasons. And, you know, they can all make sense in their own way. But I think one of the things you would probably see is, if nothing else, you're going to see guns set up such that they can fire in multiple directions. Because not only does that allow you to engage a full sphere when you're fighting, it also gives you some other options. For example, if one side of your ship is taking a beating, you can simply roll it 90 or 180 degrees and turn a fresh side of the ship to your enemy. If you want to do something like pass between an enemy formation and have enemies above you and to left of you and whatever, if you have cannons in that many directions, you can theoretically take on all these targets at once. Some people have argued, well, it might be more efficient to be able to use your weapons in concert with each other rather than have half your guns not firing at any given moment in time. And so maybe it'd be better to have a ship that's shaped something like a cone, and you kind of point that cone in the direction you want, and all of your guns are, or most of your guns are facing forward down that cone. And these are certainly all arguable points, but going back to my defense of a phrase here, whichever one of these you're talking about, you are still creating a broadside along which the ship is going to face. Now, if you like that in the more literal sense of the word, or the more narrow sense of the word, that you like the image of two giant ships passing side by side and blasting it away at each other, and that's what works for you, look, I love that too. I think it's awesome. I don't remember if it was Star Wars Episode 2 or 3, but one of them started off with a scene where they had a bunch of ships going side by side doing that kind of combat. And I was absolutely thrilled until they started reloading the laser turrets with shells. And don't tell me they were batteries, because they were ejecting casings. That's George Lucas for you. But anyway, the point being, though, that, you know, if that's what you like, go for it. But I don't think that's the way that it has to be. There is an exception somebody pointed out to me, and this sort of comes down to your preference of technology and design, which is, you might have something like a pike ship or a sniper ship, or I don't know what you want to call it, but something where it's using a weapon that requires the design to be fairly long and bulky. And so maybe it makes the most sense to simply run it down the length of the ship and there's your gun. I don't know. Maybe that works in your sci-fi and that's fine. One thing, though, I think that is certainly worth pointing out is that the guns do not have to face the direction that you are going. Now, if we talk about a modern-day fighter craft, most of them have their weapons facing forward, okay? So it's the direction that they are going. They point at it, they look at it, they put their stuff on target, and they move away. But remember that in space, you can move in any direction. You could be moving in one direction with the ship facing any other direction. You don't have to point at the thing that you are also flying at. You're better off if you think about the ship as having more freedom where its flight path and its weapons firing solution do not have to be the same line. They could be, but you don't want to lock yourself into saying they have to be. Chapter 4, Submarines and Battleships. This is another one that I did a little back and forth on, and some people raised some good points on both sides, and so I'm just going to give you every side of this argument, and you can do with this what you will. Because of the fact that space is big, and because of the fact that combat can occur in a full sphere, and there's a lot of places to hide, especially in a solar system, I've had a few people suggest that space combat actually may have more in common with submarine combat than battleship combat, meaning that you have two ships looking for each other in a very, very large, empty area, and the victory is probably going to go to the side that can spot the other one first and get off a shot. And there is some math that I can give you that would back this up, okay, that would kind of make this be plausible. So let's go with this. Let's say that you are only concerned about anything within 500,000 kilometers of your ship. So you consider anything 500,000 kilometers or closer to be a potential looming threat to your ship, that it could attack you now or could attack you at some point in the relatively near future. And to put that back in perspective, it's only a little bit farther than the distance between the Earth and the Moon. And it's a distance that a laser would cross in about a second and a half. Okay, so we're actually talking, in terms of space combat, a pretty small area. So if you work the math out on that, you get a sphere that has a diameter of 1 million kilometers. If you have a system like radar or a visual search system, the only way that you can fully explore that sphere, the only way you can fully check for everything that's going on there, is to look at every point, or at least significant points. I mean, maybe not literally every square inch, but you have to look across this area of the sphere to see if there's anything in each of those potential locations or along those potential angles of sight. Well, let me do the math here for you. If you wanted to do that, the surface area of the sphere that you're searching, ready for this? It is 3,141,592,653,589 square kilometers. All right, that's over 3 trillion square kilometers. If I want to put this in perspective for you, that would be the same as me asking you to search every square inch of the Earth's surface 6,000 times. So imagine if I gave you a bag of holding full of nothing but thumbtacks, and I said you had to put a thumbtack in literally every square inch of the Earth's surface, not once, but 6,000 times. That's the equivalent area that you are searching. To give you a real-world baseline for this, I want to talk about something called Space Guard. Space Guard is a program being run by NASA, and it's been going on for about a decade already. And what it's searching for is asteroids that might impact the Earth. Okay, obviously, it's nothing any of us want. And they have defined the ones that they consider the highest priority to map, those that are at least 140 meters across. Okay, they consider those to be the biggest danger. And despite the fact that they are looking only for asteroids 140 meters across that may threaten the Earth, they've already been searching 10 years and estimate it will be another 10 to 20 before they've actually tracked them all down. So at this point, it almost sounds like an open and shut case that finding another ship, even in relatively close proximity, it's almost a non-starter. But I want to point out that there's other things at work here. And to explain this, I need to talk about the difference between active and passive sensing. For a moment, I want you to imagine a sports stadium that seats 50,000 people, and I have just put you in the stadium. And somewhere in the stadium, one person and only one person has a camera. And I've given you a pair of binoculars, and I've said your task is to find the one person that has that camera. Now, obviously, to complete this task, the only thing you can do is take that pair of binoculars, come up with some kind of a search system, and start looking one person at a time, row by row, section by section, until you have searched every person and then found that camera. And maybe you'll get lucky and it's the first person you look at, okay? Or maybe you're not so lucky and it's the last person you look at. But that's what you have to do. You have to search these people individually. Now, I want you to imagine a second scenario. The setup's the same. I put you in a stadium of 50,000 people. One of them has a camera, and you have to find this person. The difference is, in this scenario, every 10 to 15 seconds, that person is going to take a picture using the flash on the camera. Now, you can probably pretty quickly imagine how much simpler of a task that is. You just kind of keep glancing around until you notice the flash, and then once you've seen the flash, you know the ballpark, excuse the pun, where you're looking, you narrow it down, and you're probably going to find the person a whole hell of a lot quicker than the person searching the stadium where the camera is turned off or they're not taking pictures. Now, this is the difference between active and passive sensors. This is actually something that has existed for a long time. Let me use an example of sonar. In active sonar, what happens is a ship sends out a ping of sound. Okay, it emits a noise. And based on how long it takes that noise to come back, the frequency at which it comes back, and all these other factors, they can estimate what else is out there because they created an amount of energy and it bounced back. And then they said, okay, this is what we see. That's an active sensor. There's another form of sonar called passive sonar, which is where the ship does not make a noise. Instead, all it does is it simply listens for noises, and then based on what it's hearing, tries to guess what is out there. All right, this is where you get stories about submarines or surface vessels hearing things like the engines of other submarines, or even the crew talking or singing or whatever. That's seen in Red October. That kind of thing really can happen. And that is a passive sonar. Now, let's apply this to space. If I'm saying you have to go by an active method, you have to search inch by inch through space, shooting out energy and waiting for it to come back, you're screwed. But you don't have to, in all probability. Because if you think about a spaceship, spaceships have a lot of properties that make them fairly easy to find. The first and biggest of them is the amount of heat that they emit. If we presume any kind of thrusters, obviously that's putting off a lot of heat when compared to the background of space. Even the ship's general thermal radiation, simply there to keep the crew warm, is a lot warmer than the background radiation of space. And using technology we already have today, we can take a panoramic picture of the night sky, run that through a program that knows where astronomical bodies should be, and have it come back and say, wait a minute, this, this, and this are heat markers that I can't line up to anything. You probably want to take a second look. And so despite the huge amount of area we're talking about, there are actually some fairly easy ways to find a lot of objects that are out there. Now, I realize this changes if you start dealing with things like stealth drives or engines that don't emit any kind of energy somehow, or, you know, like the Mass Effect thing where the ship recycles its own heat or stores its own heat to dump later. Okay, obviously that changes the equation. But for the general concept of ships thrusting their way around the system, they are actually somewhat easy to find despite the area that is being dealt with. Now, of course, also this obviously changes if you're dealing with things that are faster than light. A ship moving faster than light may not be struck by slower than light sensing methods. Things like the heat it's putting off, infrared light, whatever. These kinds of things may not pan out in any way that we could really understand or measure. And obviously all kinds of theories about this, because who knows. But the point being that, yes, faster than light travel could dork it up. So chapter 5, let's talk about faster than light travel. I want to talk about why faster than light travel is really difficult. And then I want to talk about some possible solutions to it. There have been a lot of points in human history when people have said, we as a species can't do things. We can't fly. We can't break the sound barrier. There were people that had all these evidences of why you could not break the sound barrier. And obviously we went on and did these things. And so I think it is somewhat easy when we hear that faster than light travel is impossible that we kind of take the same sort of attitude. Well, we got past these other things. Maybe we don't have any ideas for it now, but we'll figure it out someday. And maybe we will. Once, as I said at the start of all this, I have no interest in posing as a futurist or a theoretical physicist. But I want to explain to you some of the problems that exist that make faster-than-light travel uniquely difficult when compared to all these other hurdles that mankind has jumped through. One thing that our species already has going for it is we've actually come up with a pretty good number of ideas for how to move a ship slower than light. Rockets are the ones that probably most people are familiar with, but they're not the only one out there. We also have ideas for solar sails and ion drives and all this other crazy stuff. And I'll put a link in the show notes to, I think it's an article on NASA that talks about some of these different theoretical drives they're working with. Well, let's talk about the scope and scale here of faster than light travel. I'm going to start by talking about the fastest man-made object. It's actually two objects. It's Helios 1 and 2. The fastest man-made objects, and they travel at 250,000 kilometers per hour. Now, if we talk about our nearest neighbor, we'll go with Alpha Centauri here, it's 4.37 light years away. To give you some numbers on that, that's about 41,500,000,000,000 kilometers away, long ass distance, right? If we take that fastest man-made object, Helios 1 and 2, which after acceleration topped out at 250,000 kilometers per hour, it would take those little probes 19,000 years to reach Alpha Centauri. Okay, obviously not real great. So how do we get around this? Well, our first gut instinct is to start adding speed, right? I talked about earlier how acceleration is really the thing in space. Speed only becomes a thing when acceleration stops. So, hey, why not just keep accelerating? Let's just keep rushing along. In fact, actually, you can do some kind of cool math with this, because since we don't really have a good way of producing consistent thrust for that long, a mission to Mars, we estimate it would take us, you know, a bunch of months to get there and then a bunch of months to get back. And I think one of the projects they have in mind actually doesn't have the people returning, which is kind of morbid, but whatever. If you could actually do acceleration equal to one gravity, okay, so you're accelerating at the same rate as something falling on Earth. This produces several pretty cool effects. First of all, because it's accelerating at one gravity, which is like 9.8 meters per second per second, if you put the floor of the ship such that your feet are pointing the same direction as the thruster, that acceleration, that spaceship pushing up against you, actually creates artificial gravity for you. So you don't have to deal with weightlessness and, you know, crappy chicken in a toothpaste tube or whatever. You actually have, you know, regular stuff, right? That's pretty cool. The other thing is you have to keep in mind that once you reach your top speed, you don't want to stay at that speed because you're just going to splatter all over Mars once you get there. So the way that you deal with this is at the halfway point, the ship flips over and then begins a one gravity or one G burn in the opposite direction. Okay, now some people will bicker on this. That's technically acceleration. I'm going to call it deceleration just to be a dick. But you're now doing a 1G acceleration or deceleration going the other way. And so you have full gravity going both directions. And incidentally, if you played Mass Effect 2, there was actually a joke about this. If you're walking through the Citadel in one of the shops, you talk to a guy who's selling navigational software, and he makes a joke about stupid customers who come in and complain that their ship's turning around when it's only halfway there. That's what the joke was about, was that reverse acceleration or deceleration as the ship was approaching its target. But point being, if you can do this, the trip to Mars actually only takes a few days. Even trips to farther out planets like Jupiter and such, you can actually measure in about 3 weeks. It's really not all that far. It doesn't take that long to get there. And so maybe this is the route we want to go. We say, well, we want to get to this planet faster, so let's just keep adding more speed into the equation, right? Well, that's got some problems of its own. First of all, we have a problem with mass. Every object has mass, which represents just the amount of stuff it's made up of. We see this most commonly expressed through weight, okay? But weight and mass are technically not quite the same thing, because weight is how much something pulls down, I guess for lack of a better phrasing, in gravity, whereas mass still exists without gravity, okay? So if I go into space, I am weightless, but I still have mass. I am still composed of matter. And so what we have observed is that as an object accelerates faster and faster, its actual mass remains the same. But what changes is its effective mass, or apparent mass, it has a few different names it goes by, starts to increase. So basically, the faster an object goes, it begins to behave as if it had a higher mass than it actually does. And this produces a couple problems. Now, at the lower end of acceleration, it's actually not that big of a deal. If you look at, I think it's something like up to 14% of the speed of light only actually alters your apparent mass by something like 1%. But the closer you get to the speed of light, that curve turns up sharply until the point where you hit the speed of light, at which point you have an infinite apparent mass or effective mass, all right? So it's as if you had an infinite mass. So in addition to the fact that your mass is increasing, and I'm going to talk in a second about some of the effects that that can have, to even do this in the first place, you have to start off with a whole lot of fuel. Because if you're just going to keep burning and burning and burning and burning, and we don't assume you develop some really cool new technology that lets you do this without having some enormous amount of fuel, then when that ship starts off, it has to have an enormous amount of fuel, which means that the energy it takes to get that ship moving is going to be greater. And you're only going to get more efficient thrust out of it as you are running out of fuel. Another problem we have that comes from mass, or this apparent mass, It has to do with a nice little thing we get from general relativity. Something that we have been able to demonstrate and prove is that as mass increases, time slows down. And that is true for both actual mass and apparent mass. Let me talk to you about how we've proven this. We have these highly accurate clocks that are based off of cesium, and they can actually track the actions of these atoms down to, I mean, extremely, extremely, really detailed stuff. You can Google this if you really want to understand the details. And there are two experiments that have been done with these cesium clocks that come to mind. I'm sure a bunch have been done, but I'm telling you about two in particular. One of them was to put a cesium clock on an airplane and have it fly around the world. Okay, so that means this airplane's obviously moving faster than the surface of the planet. And what they found is that when that airplane had landed, because it was operating under a higher effective mass than anything on the ground, time had slowed down for it. They've also done this, incidentally, on tall buildings. You can put a cesium clock on the ground floor and a cesium clock on the top floor, leave them there for a while, and when you bring them back down and have them compare notes, they have experienced different amounts of times. Now, in this case, what I'm talking about are things that are so minute, it's really not perceptible. We're talking about like millionths of a second. All right, this doesn't really matter. But what would happen if you're talking about this on a large scale is if you start accelerating way up towards the speed of light using conventional means, then you get this problem where time's slowing down for you. So you go on a quick run around the solar system, and maybe for you, it seems like only a matter of days has passed. But by the time that you arrive back at the point you came from, it's possible that centuries or even millennia have passed. And it just seems like it'd be awfully embarrassing to set out on some faster than light or near light trip off to someplace like Alpha Centauri, only to find out by the time you arrive that the planet was actually colonized 1500 years ago by ships that surpassed yours in technology. So is it possible to still get from one star system to another? Do we have any ways around this? And the answer is yes, we do. The first option is simply to accept slow moving ships. And there have been some great sci-fi series that have used this as one of their linchpins of how things work, that these ships don't go faster than light. They go fast, but not that fast. And what happens is one of two things. Either you have the people in stasis on that ship, and so you may get on the ship and get frozen, and when you wake up, you're at another star system, but thousands of years really have passed. That's how long you've been frozen. And that's just as far as technology goes, and that's how they tell their stories. Another concept is the idea of a generation ship. And what a generation ship is, as the name implies, there are generations of people that live on this ship. So you create a stable ecosystem, you create a stable society, you probably do some, you know, engineering about who can breed and how often and such. But the idea is that you set off on this voyage and live and die on the ship, and then your children are born there and they live and die on the ship, and the grandchildren are born and live and die on the ship. And eventually this ship reaches its destination, and who knows how many rounds of people have lived and died during this voyage, but the ship simply never went faster than light. It just didn't break any of these difficulties we're talking about. All right, but that's, yeah, I don't know. It's not everybody's cup of tea. When I tell science fiction stories, I like faster than light travel. I want it to work, even if it's something that's not physically possible, which we don't know for a fact, but let's just, you know, for sake of argument, say it could be. And there are some ways around this. The first one is the idea of moving in a dimension that we can't quite perceive. One of the most common examples of this is something like a wormhole. Let's say that we were talking to a two-dimensional being, a being that sees length and width but does not see height. And let's say that we drew a racetrack for this being. And so we drew a rough, I don't know, like a donut shape on a piece of paper. And the outer line of the donut represents one edge of the track, and the inner line represents the other edge of this track he has to run around. And let's say that the total circumference through the middle of this track is, I don't know, 2 feet. And let's furthermore say that we go to one edge of that track and we draw a line through the track. Okay, so we've cut it off. So the track is now no longer a complete circle. There's a line through there. And so if we ask this two-dimensional creature, If we put a dot on one side of that line, that's the starting point, and we put a dot on the other side of that line, that's the ending point, and we ask him, what is the shortest distance between these two points? Well, his answer is going to be 2 feet. To him, there is physically no other way to reach the end point than to follow this track all the way around. In the same way, we might look at the night sky and say, well, this star is some number of light years away. But it is theoretically possible that there might be some way to move in an additional dimension. Okay, so going back to our lap that we're trying to do with our two-dimensional creature, we as three-dimensional creatures can look at that track and say, no, actually, point A and point B are not 2 feet apart. They are, in fact, basically right next to each other. And the shortest distance between the two is simply to skip over that line. And, you know, just pick up your pencil, move it over the line, and boom, you're at the end point. So, in fact, this end point, it's not 2 feet away. It's, in fact, maybe just like, I don't know, a quarter of an inch away from the start point. And maybe in the same way, if we could perceive it the right way, or if we could mess up the universe the right way, somehow Mars is, in fact, within arm's reach of Earth. And I'm being intentionally somewhat a little bit vague and inaccurate here, but bear with me. I'm just trying to explain these things in simple metaphors. Another way you could look at it is imagine if I drew a start point at the top of a piece of paper and an end point at the bottom of a piece of paper. Well, we could certainly perceive that the quickest way to get those 2 points together would be to fold the piece of paper in half. All right, so the idea is that you're changing the rules about what the distance is between these 2 points by having these points behave in a way other than what we normally perceive. Now, another possibility, and this is one that, as far as I know, resides purely in the realm of fiction. I don't know if there's any actual theories on this one or not, is the concept of something like hyperspace or witch space or end space. I've heard it have a number of names. But the idea is that basically you can drop out of this universe or this reality and re-enter it somewhere else. And that maybe the distance between point A and point B in our reality is 20 light years. But if you could kind of sidestep out into some other place, you could actually drop back in at a much closer point. One of the more popular forms of faster than light travel is a category of drives called the Alcubierre drives. The most famous of the Alcubierre drives is probably Star Trek's warp drive, but these all work along similar principles. The idea being that if you can only move across space and time, you can only move across the fabric of our universe by obeying certain rules, which includes things like the faster you go, you increase your mass and so on and so forth. The idea is, what if you could kind of cheat by, instead of moving you could actually just kind of deform or break off a piece of space-time and move that? Because space-time would, since it itself does not have mass or whatever, it's not going to have to play by the same rules. And so the idea is that instead of your ship moving, your ship is technically staying still, but what's happening is that space around your ship is bending in such a way, or is being moved in such a way, that it's dragging the ship from place to place. I don't know that I can give you a really good metaphor for this one in the real world, except perhaps a somewhat weak analogy. If you can picture yourself being on a train while it's moving, let's say this train is going 100 miles an hour. Now, nobody listening to this show can run 100 miles an hour, but everyone that's on that train, because you're already going 100 miles an hour, that train is moving, you could get up and, of course, walk up and down the aisles. And if you're walking up that aisle at 1 mile an hour, technically you're moving forward at 101 miles per hour, even though that's really not what you're actually doing. And that's not really a great metaphor, but I hope that at least give you some kind of a loose reference point of how that sort of drive works. And once again, if you're really interested in this stuff and you really want to get it pedantically right, then hit Google. There is no shortage of information on stuff like this. In chapter 6, I want to talk about one of the perhaps unintended consequences of allowing faster than light travel. And this is something that a lot of science fiction doesn't deal with. I have seen some science fiction deal with this. Imagine for a moment that you are standing some distance away from me, let's say, you know, about 20 feet. And I have a baseball in my hand. And at first, I take that baseball and I do a really gentle, very slow underhanded toss. And that baseball hits you. Obviously not too big of a deal. Annoying, but not dangerous. Now imagine that I step aside and we get a Major League Baseball pitcher who he steps up. He takes a baseball and he does an overhanded 90 mile an hour fastball into you. Depending on where that hits you, you're probably going to be injured. You might be seriously injured. It is possible you could have just been killed by this. I want to introduce the concept of the relativistic kill vehicle. Obviously, it's a fairly bad idea, at least from the receiving end, for someone to take something like a giant rock and, you know, an asteroid and dump it on a planet. We're well aware of this potential extinction event. And the popularized name for that is mass driving, that you just put a bunch of thrusters or something on an asteroid, run it into a planet, and just the sheer mass of the thing, you know, nature takes its course. This has been referenced in a bunch of science fiction. There was a expansion, a DLC for Mass Effect 1 that dealt with this. But I want you to imagine something even more dangerous than that, because if you look at the total force that is behind a huge rock going 5 or 10% of the speed of light, it's pretty bad. But I could take something like a little shuttle that doesn't weigh more than a few tons, and if we presuppose the existence of faster than light drives, and I could get this thing up to several times the speed of light, I could hit a planet with far more force. In fact, it would be such destructive force that it is entirely possible the planet would not remain, that all that would be left behind is a debris field. This is called a relativistic kill vehicle. Now, obviously, only some forms of faster than light travel would allow for this. If, for example, you're doing something like moving in some imperceptible dimension, well, then you're really not ever actually going that fast. But if you say something like, hey, we have a drive that can allow us to go in a straight line many times the speed of light, one little dude in a shuttle is far more destructive than an entire fleet packing weapons of mass destruction. Now, there are a few ways around this if you don't want to deal with constant wars of extinction in your fiction. Now, obviously, something's going to be diplomatic. Here on Earth, we have atomic bombs. They've only been used in military conflict once, and, you know, God willing, they'll never be used again that way. So maybe you have that kind of thing, or you're doing this sort of Red Storm Rising, where everyone's just kind of agreed that going to that level is not a really good idea, and that just works in your fiction. Maybe it's not possible. For example, in Battletech, there they use a jump drive, so it's not per se a straight line drive, but the faster-than-light drives only work in the absence of gravity. So what that means is you can't jump into or at a planet because the jump drive wouldn't function. In the same way, you could say that, well, if you're going like with an Alcubierre drive, maybe for some reason those distortions of space and time and gravity fall apart in the presence of gravity or mass or whatever, that they can only handle certain things, you know, like they can get around micrometeoroids or whatever, but they cannot take actually getting up to a planet. So it is something to think about. It's also possible that there's some way to disrupt these drives or to interdict against these drives, that maybe it just becomes a common defense that, yeah, someone could take a faster than light vehicle and run it into a planet, but everybody knows it. And so as a result, planets have a defensive grid of all these satellites that produce these interdicting fields that disrupt faster than light travel. I don't know. I don't have a good answer for you because the faster than light travel itself is so theoretical that trying to figure out how you would stop it from being used as a weapon is even more theoretical. These next few I'm going to bounce through pretty quickly here. These are all kind of short topics that I want to hit on, and these are ones that I actually did not get to in the blog posts. The first one I want to hit on here, so we'll call this Chapter 7, is robots versus humans. And I don't mean this like the Terminator. I don't mean robots fighting humans. A lot of people have theorized that if we were to ever have contact with aliens, it is wholly possible that what we would have contact with is not the species itself, but some kind of an automated probe that it sent out ahead of itself. Now, there's certainly good reason to think this might be the case. We, for example, have put a whole bunch of robots on Mars. In fact, there's a running joke that Mars is the only known planet fully inhabited by robots. And it's true, I mean, to the best of our knowledge. But, you know, I think the same thing in terms of interstellar exploration, not just intrastellar exploration. If we had some ability to go to another star system, I have to imagine we'd send robots first. Well, why would we do that? Well, there's many reasons. For starters, I think the vast majority of us, and I think pretty much any sane human being would agree that the loss of an expensive and complicated machine sucks, but it really, in the grand scheme of things, does not matter. If I had a button and pressing it meant that either a robot was going to die or a human was going to die, and I got to pick which, I'm going to choose the NASA probe every single time because, you know, there's a value to human life. But there's other things to consider as well. For example, robots do not require air. While they may require heat, they do not require heat in the same amount that we require. They do not require as much energy. For example, you can put a robot into sleep mode far easier than you can a human. Even if you put a human into stasis, the body does not actually drop below freezing. And so you still have to maintain heat for that body that's above the general ambient temperature of space. You have to keep feeding that person some amount of nutrients. If that person is awake, or even if they are asleep, you have to deal with waste products. You have to scrub the carbon dioxide out of the air and keep the oxygen fresh. And there's all these things that you have to deal with. We can go even beyond that to softer things. Do they have enough room to exercise? Are they being able to socialize? Are they going insane from solitary confinement on the spaceship? Are they having medical problems? And these are all kinds of things that robots either don't have to deal with or don't deal with in the same level that people do. Now, I don't think that if we had the capacity of really complicated space travel, that robots would replace people, unless we're talking about the AI's takeover kind of scenario. There's some science fiction that says, well, people become so decadent and all this kind of crap, and so the robots do everything and people really just sit on Earth because it's too complicated to send us out there. I don't buy it. And the reason I don't buy it is because we as a species are absolutely driven by curiosity, and a curiosity that is only sated by experience. We want to see things, touch things, interact with things, try things. This is hardwired into who and what we are. If it wasn't our culture, our technology, none of these things would have advanced because we would have no interest in understanding things and then communicating that understanding. One of the coolest experiences of my life was touching an actual moon rock. Now, I've seen the moon. Everybody listening to this podcast, assuming you're not vision impaired, has seen the moon. We know it's up there, right? This is not a novel object to anyone, but there was something special about being able to touch it. And so, yes, it is likely that robots would be at the edge of what we're doing, and robots may even take over certain roles like dangerous mining or distant exploration or even warfare. But I really just don't buy that we would be okay sitting this whole thing out. I mean, even if you look at society when it was at its most decadent, for example, let's take a look at some of like the Roman history. They were still really big in exploration and tourism. A little bit of stupid trivia. One of the favorite tourist destinations for Romans was Sparta. Chapter 8, ship damage. I have a couple thoughts on this. First of all, shields. Do you want to deal with shields in your sci-fi? Let me give you a few thoughts on shields. I personally don't like shields because to me, it's freebie damage. I don't like the idea that a ship can be hit and it doesn't matter. But maybe that's what you want. You don't want people to have to deal with, you know, their ass getting kicked on the first hit. You want some give in there, and that's fine. Let me give you a few thoughts of things you might want to do. With most of the ideas for energy barriers we have with modern technology, and incidentally, we actually do have a few. One of the things they all have in common is they generally only work against a single type of energy. Okay, for example, you can create a magnetic field that will stop magnetic forces. You can create plasma fields that can actually block things like low pressures of air and such. But the idea of creating a barrier of energy that blocks any and all kinds of force or energy being affected against it is not something we have. I'm not saying you can't create this for your sci-fi, but it could be a way of spinning it of maybe you do something. And they did this in a few of the iterations of Star Trek, which is terrible for internal consistency on its technology, where, for example, shields did a lot against phasers and disruptors, but didn't offer much defense against photon torpedoes. Within shields, there are two types of shields, or two general models of how a shield would defend something, and that's barrier shields and leaky shields. The barrier shields, what that means is the shields take a certain amount of damage before they are simply gone. All right, it works much like armor, except it's just a regenerating energy field. So if we put this in a role-playing game, let's say maybe the shield can take 20 points of damage, and as soon as you do a 21st point of damage, that goes through and hits the ship. The other model is leaky shields, and a leaky shield will block a percentage of incoming damage, maybe, let's say, a lot, maybe 90% of damage. So if I hit you with a weapon that does 20 points of damage, your shields are going to block the first 18, but the next two are going to get through. And the leaky shields allow your shields to serve some purpose without them actually outright mitigating all incoming damage, as with so many other things, cooked to taste. The last two things I want to hit on, I guess we can call these chapter 9, but they're really just kind of closing thoughts. The first one is so brief. It's just, I don't know, this is just something that's stuck in my craw. I've never really liked the way that so much about space combat is tied back to the Navy. I mean, I get why there's the parallels. You have large ships, the ships exist in fleets. You could very easily size class them in things like destroyer, cruiser, battleship, frigate, corvette, whatever. But I have to imagine that if we were to have a fleet of spaceships in 100 or 200 years, if you look at the space program we have today, while all the branches of the military are involved, it is predominantly an Air Force undertaking. And that's why if you read any of the science fiction that I've written for like Sojourn or whatever, you'll notice that the spaceship people are actually using Air Force ranks, not Navy ranks. There's no admirals, there's generals. It doesn't really matter, just me being nitpicky. But something else I want to hit on here is my thoughts on tabletop games, right? It's a tabletop gaming podcast, so I have to throw us in here somewhere. What are my thoughts on tabletop games that deal with spaceship combat? And I'm going to start with something that will probably surprise no one, which is the favorite system of mine is the old FASA ship-on-ship combat system. I love it because of the fact that you play individual consoles. It gives you the sense that you are part of a complex machine. I think it simulates a lot of the ideas of space combat pretty well, and I've had a lot of fun playing it. Though it was actually a different FASA game that I would credit for being even more accurate, though perhaps a bit less immersive, which was Renegade Legion. Because in Renegade Legion, ships did not have speed. They actually had acceleration, and the faster you were going, the harder it got to turn because you're trying to overcome that inertia and all this stuff. And it was kind of complicated, but it was also kind of cool. One of the problems that I've had with a lot of space combat systems in general is it's really hard in a 2D or two-dimensional play surface to really represent three-dimensional combat. And I've seen systems do it by having sliders that indicate where a ship is, or they might even move up and down on the stand that they sit on or whatever. And yeah, it's out there. But I've never really seen a system that I think captures it incredibly well, which is why, in my mind, and this is, once again, just personal taste, I would rather go for a little bit of simplicity and say, we're going to cut some corners here. It's not going to be perfectly accurate, but it'd be better to cut some corners than it would be to get super accurate about something like 2D combat, which isn't even accurate to space combat to begin with. Anyway, I hope you guys have enjoyed this. Thank you to those of you who stuck through this, and I hope it was worth your while. We can always continue these discussions on the forums. And if you want to nitpick my terminology, once again, I was just painting at high levels here. So there's plenty of room to do that. But hey, if you want to do that, that's what we geeks do. All right. That's how we geek out about stuff. So that's totally fine. Stop by the forums to discuss it, whatever. If there's a surprising amount of interest, I don't know, maybe we'll do a follow-up to this, but probably not because the other host would kill me. So anyways, thank you guys for tuning in. And as I said before, if this was not your cup of tea, I don't know what the hell you're still doing here 2 hours in, but next week we will be back with a more traditional episode of Fear the Boot, and we will catch you then.
Thank you.